They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back. Crossover NBA Podcast. Down here in the bubble. Got a good show lined up for you. Talk a little NBA draft on this show. Jeremy Wu, the NBA draft analyst with SI and SI.com. He'll join me. We have the draft order set. Minnesota sitting there at number one. What are they going to do? The Warriors, how appealing is that number two pick? And where does Jeremy slot LaMelo Ball into the mix? Easily the most fascinating player in this draft. Talked about him about that and much more. A little bit later on, Taj Gibson, Knicks forward. He is out there doing some things in the Brooklyn community that he wants to talk about. And I want to get into some of the things happening with the social justice movement here in the bubble, get his thoughts on everything that's happening in this NBA restart. The other topic I want to get to, because I don't get into it with any of my guests, the Sixers, they moved on from Brett Brown. I wrote about this on SI.com on Sunday. You can check out that column if you want my kind of full thoughts on it. I understand that a coach is often the scapegoat, and Brett Brown had 7 years in Philadelphia, certainly not flawless as a head coach. But let's not sit here and act like the firing of Brett Brown is going to change things for Philadelphia. Philadelphia's mistakes are far more deeply rooted. Philadelphia had a team last year that maybe was one bounce of the ball from getting to the conference finals. If that Kawhi Leonard shot doesn't go in at the end of regulation in Game 7, that game goes to overtime, and who knows what happens there. And if the Sixers win that game, did they go on to beat Milwaukee? Did they go on to beat Golden State in the finals? Is Brett Brown really defined by one bounce of a basketball? Like, Brett Brown, not the fundamental problem in Philadelphia. The fact that after that year, the 76ers didn't bring back Jimmy Butler, didn't bring back J.J. Redick, completely changed the balance of the roster by bringing in Al Horford and giving Tobias Harris a max-level contract, that will loom as the biggest mistake the Sixers made. Butler would have been a risk, giving a five-year contract worth in the neighborhood of $190 million, but we're seeing what Jimmy Butler is doing down in Miami. I guess J.J. Redick would have been a risk at the 2 years, almost $27 million he got from New Orleans, but that team couldn't use a J.J. Redick right now. The floor spacing with the Sixers is terrible. That team absolutely could have used a J.J. Redick. So, Brett Brown may go, and I believe that Ty Lue is the first choice of management, of ownership. I've reported that there is mutual interest between Ty Lue and the 76ers. Ty is an excellent coach. He would do an excellent job with that team. He is one of the few coaches out there that has a proven track record at being able to work with superstars. And Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, while not on the LeBron James level, are right below it. So, you know, Ty Lue would be an excellent choice, but Ty Lue's not a miracle worker. If you don't change the dynamics of that roster, if you don't get more shooting on that roster, if you don't help create more spacing on that roster, you're not going to succeed. I don't believe that trading Ben Simmons or Joel Embiid makes any sense. Ben Simmons, for all his flaws, is a terror out there on the floor. He is a great player. Joel Embiid is a great player. Both these players are in their mid-20s. You don't move off guys like that if you are not getting dollar-for-dollar value back in return. But I wonder if we look back on the Sixers team 5 years from now and say they blew their opportunity to win a championship with Simmons and Embiid when they let Jimmy Butler go, when they let J.J. Redick go. Did they screw it up? I think that's something that 5 years from now we may ultimately wonder. So Brett Brown, he'll land on his feet. He'll probably take a year off, enjoy his life. I mean, the guy was part of the process, man, from the very beginning. He suffered through some god-awful seasons there early on, a 10-win season just 4 years ago. He deserves a break. When he's ready to get back in the game, there will definitely be lead assistant coaching opportunities for him, and perhaps there may be head coaching opportunities in the right situation for a guy that has proven that he can develop young players and get them to a certain level. So changes in Philadelphia, but temper your expectations. The Brett Brown firing is not going to solve all their problems. All right, let's talk some NBA draft next. Here is my conversation with SI.com's Jeremy Wu. All right, Jeremy Wu is here, SI.com NBA draft analyst. His life is starting to finally get busy again with the lottery results in. We're going to have some virtual combines coming up at some point. We're going to have an NBA draft, and Jeremy joins me here on the show. So let's start with the draft itself, Jeremy. Do you have any anticipation for when that date is going to be? It's clearly not going to be in mid-October as originally planned.
Yeah, the latest thing I've heard is that everyone's kind of now looking at November. So the original October 16th, like, I think that was the first time they pushed it back. I think just with, these ongoing salary cap negotiations and with the news that, they're going to push back the date for, bargaining that, I would guess, the draft ends up being, early to mid November. I mean, maybe we could even be looking at like closer to Thanksgiving. I don't think it's like a rush at this point. They have to get the salary cap stuff right. And if you're going to push back free agency, there's not really much point in drafting and then waiting, right? So it makes sense to me.
So what's been the impact on guys that have entered the draft and kind of the limbo that they've been in? I mean, if the guys you've talked to, have they been able to work out? I mean, has it been how much uncertainty has been out there as a result of the what's gone on?
I think it's just more of like an isolating process right now. Some agencies aren't really doing like full scale pre-draft. A lot of agencies, sign smaller, draft classes to begin with. So you have guys kind of working out at scattered locations around the country. Obviously can't do big group workouts. So it's harder to play 5-on-5. And no one's coming to watch you work out really either, because teams aren't cleared to do anything. So it's just like it's just been a very protracted process. I think everyone's a little bit just ready to get this over with at this point, both on the team and the player side.
All right, so the NBA, in its clear desire to make the Timberwolves the dominant franchise in the league, have given Minnesota the number one pick for the third time in the last 6 years, from Andrew Wiggins to Karl Anthony Towns, and now they're sitting at number one right now with a chance to reshape their roster once again. So, a lot of this conversation, Jeremy, is going to be kind of NBA draft for dummies, because I am a dummy when it comes to the NBA draft right now. I mean, I know a handful of the guys at the top, but I guess my first question is going to be, at this point, is there a consensus number one? I mean, I know you have Anthony Edwards going number one to Minnesota. I mean, how certain are you that he's the number one pick?
So I feel fairly good about him being number one, as long as they keep pick, which I think they will. As far as a consensus number one, I still think that, if you ask 10 to 15 different people around the NBA, you might get a different answer. And that's just sort of been the nature of this draft class. Between Edwards and James Wiseman and LaMelo Ball, I mean, these guys are all a little bit different. But not that necessarily that far apart in terms of how people view their talent. But if I had to bet, I think Edwards makes a lot of sense in Minnesota. So ultimately, I think that's what they'll do. But that's just my gut.
Do you think he makes a lot of sense because, look, he's a guard or a two guard, and there's a point guard entrenched in Minnesota. There's a power forward / center entrenched in Minnesota. Does he make sense positionally, or do you believe he's the best player in this draft class?
So positionally definitely makes sense. Do I think he's the best player? Yes. But do I feel like crazy confident about that? Not necessarily, but I do think he has the best chance, to be that third wheel for them. Right. And sometimes it's tough picking number one just because the expectations that come with it. But if you just look at it, as far as like what are the options for them, I mean, they're not going to take Wiseman. That wouldn't make sense unless they would want to play really, really big with Towns, which isn't what I don't think anybody would necessarily prescribe with the way the NBA is going, right? I mean, you could maybe argue for trying something different like that, but I mean, it's not what I would do. I don't think Wiseman is that type of guy. You know, and then with Ball, you know, A, you really have to believe in him to take him one, but B, you know, the fit with Russell would not be great. And also, I think if you look, if you just look at the moves that Minnesota's made in the last year, you know, since Gerson took over, you know, it's been, you know, they did a lot to get D'Angelo Russell, and then they got Malik Beasley, and you know, they've invested a lot in trying to get that backcourt fit right. You know, would having Beasley preclude you from taking Edwards? Probably not. But if you take LaMelo Ball and you put him on that team, I mean, do you risk, you know, upsetting Russell? If you upset Russell, does that upset Karl Towns? You know, because you know, those two guys are such close friends. So that, you have to think about the dynamic there. I don't think Minnesota is at fault, you know, for taking Edwards and viewing him as the best pick. It's what I would do if I had to pick. But again, this is the kind of year where no one really, really, really wanted to have that pick. But at least for Minnesota, it's a fairly clear-cut decision, just from my perspective.
Do you think theoretically, I mean, watching the Blazers play, you see two guys that are basically point guards, and CJ McCollum and Damian Lillard have a lot of success, you know, playing off each other. I mean, is it theoretically possible that LaMelo and D'Angelo Russell could achieve that type of dynamic if they were paired together, or are their skill sets just, you know, too comparable and that they're not fit to play together?
Well, I would feel better about it if LaMelo was a better shooter right now. But so much of his shooting projection is just based on you think he'll get better because XYZ, right? And that's not to like poo-poo that point. Like, I can understand why you think he'll get better at shooting, but just from a spacing standpoint, you know, that's an issue. Russell is not a guy who puts a lot of pressure on the rim. You know, he does more damage on the outside, you know, playing pick and roll. You know, I think you'd have a pretty good transition team. And LaMelo is big enough that you could sort of like park him away from the ball defensively because he's not going to guard on the ball anyway, really. But I just think between the fact that, you know, Minnesota is already kind of a team that has really struggled defensively, you know, they're trying to figure out, you know, the right combination of guys around Towns. I just think that you risk a little bit too much overlap as far as what Ball and Russell would like to do together. So for me, it's tough to see that working.
What is the word on LaMelo's shot? I mean, and first of all, what is it with these Ball brothers and their shooting strokes? I mean, LiAngelo's is actually pretty pure, but I mean, of the two guys that are going to be in the NBA together, you know, Lonzo had his difficulties early on. He made changes this year with New Orleans. And LaMelo, the best way I could describe it, Jeremy, is that it looks like Joakim Noah's shot. Like it's sort of, you know, two-handed almost, and the elbow's awkwardly placed. I mean, how much reconstruction are we talking about with LaMelo Ball's shot when he gets to the NBA?
Yeah, you know, it's just going to depend on if a team wants to mess with it. I think there's, you know, a school of thought that, you know, you always try to make the right tweaks. And with Lonzo, you know, that eventually happened to the point where now he's at least a consistent set shooter for the most part. I think, you know, in the bubble, he wasn't great. But, you know, if you look at the course of the year, you know, he shot it pretty well. But also there's the school of thought where it's like, well, if it goes in, you know, leave it alone. With LaMelo, he took a lot of tough shots in Australia. And that's one thing, like, I don't think, I would hope he's not shooting like crazy step backs, right? But at the same time, that's kind of what he does. So the way I'd frame it is it's just like, I'm not confident that he's going to be a shooter who can really turn like those deep above the break threes he likes to take into good shots. I mean, you can list the guys who that's a good shot for on one hand, really, you know, Steph Curry, Damian Lillard, guys like that who can really just like pull from deep off the dribble and you have to respect it. I'm not confident LaMelo is going to be one of those guys, but I am confident he's always going to love shooting that shot, right? That's just who he is. So I guess I'm a little bit more skeptical than some. I think he's a top five player in the draft just off talent. And, you know, I think he does love to play basketball, you know, clearly, you know, he gets some joy just from playing. He hasn't won a lot yet, which is also a thing people are concerned about, but at the same time, he's been in such weird situations. I don't know how much you can really hold it against him. But I think the biggest thing is just that he's going to need to land in a really, really good situation. But also because his skill set is so specific, I think there's a pretty good chance that he at least ends up on a team that will sort of bring him along in the right way and sort of give him the right amount of freedom.
What is that good situation then? Because, I mean, I think a lot of people were earmarking him for the Knicks. It seems unlikely that he gets that far down to number 8 at this point. But is there a good situation you see that you know, LaMelo could step into and you say that's the right fit?
Yeah, well, so the three teams that stand out the most, Chicago is one where I just think that there's such a need for playmaking that you could take him even with Coby White on the roster. I think Coby White is probably going to be better off as your third guard or sort of like a microwave scorer type guy. And so I think you could justify taking him if you're Chicago at number four. I think Detroit and New York were the two teams that people looked at as potential destinations where you know, he clearly fits a need and they have a hole at point guard. So I'm curious to see if there's a trade market that emerges, you know, those three teams. I don't think Charlotte's going to do it. I mean, they could, and if I were them, I would think about it, but it's hard for me to see that, at least right now, happening. I think Charlotte is probably more likely to go with one of the bigs, is my guess. And I don't think Golden State's taking LaMelo at number two. So, you know, is there a trade market that emerges? Will Detroit or New York try to come up to take him? We'll see, right? But, you know, he could be there for the Bulls at number four. I think that's something they have to think about, too.
I just, in some ways, I don't know what I'm looking at with LaMelo, largely because I don't know. I mean, I see the talent, obviously. He's got a great flair, you know, great passing ability, playmakes in the open floor, but you know, he hasn't played. I mean, has he even played a whole season anywhere? I mean, he played, how many games did he play in Australia? Then he played in Lithuania, then that ridiculous Junior Basketball Association in the U.S. I mean, how concerned are teams by not knowing what they have in LaMelo based on what they've seen, who he's played against?
You know, I don't know if that's a huge concern necessarily, just because I think if you look at him and you watch him enough, I mean, it's easy to see that if you dropped him onto a college team this year, he would have been pretty good. Like, at least from accounting stats standpoint, like, I think he would have been, you know, a very good college player. But you know, that question of translation is always the thing. I think for him, it's less a question of what does he do well, and it's just, you know, how do we get him to do it in a way that's conducive to, you know, building a winning program. And you know, as much as it seems ridiculous, I think there is still a little bit of trepidation about, you know, LaVar Ball, all the stuff that, you know, he sometimes is responsible for in terms of distractions. It might be more of a high maintenance situation, which, you know, some teams it's fine. Some teams don't want that. But I don't think it's so much that people doubt the talent, but it's just like, will he shoot? And then, you know, do we have a fit for
him? I'm fascinated by number one here, because this is such a seminal moment for Gerson Rosas, Ryan Saunders, that whole organization. I mean, they blew the Wiggins pick. I mean, looking back in hindsight, they had drafted Joel Embiid, just waited for him. I mean, what could that team have ultimately been? Karl Towns, a terrific player. But, I mean, it doesn't feel like it's hyperbole, Jeremy, to say, like, this is the future of the organization right here. This pick. Because there is so much ambiguity at the top. They have to get this right. I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. Like, who is the worst team in the Western Conference next year? It's probably Minnesota, you know, based on the level of talent that's above him. Maybe you can say it's Sacramento, but they're a team that is at least, you know, theoretically on the rise. They've got to hit this, don't they? Like, I just wonder what we're going to look back on 5 years from now. And will we say, well, should they have taken James Wiseman but didn't because they already had a big man in their front court? You know, I it's just such a big risk to not take the best guy available no matter what. That's just the way I kind of see it. Like, whoever they identify as the best player in this draft, I feel like they've got to take the best player in this draft.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think it's Wiseman. So for me, that's not a conundrum, just because I don't like – I think Wiseman will be productive, but I don't think he's like – a make or break guy. I mean, and again, from that perspective, I think it is Edwards. I think that, you know, the other thing with him is that he does have potential to be a really good defender. He doesn't always want to do it. And you have to hope that you can sort of help him, you know, that becomes part of his identity. Right. But he's really, really, has really good balance laterally. You know, I scouted him live a few times this year, and when he wants to get a stop, he's going to get a stop a lot of the time. And he's big enough to guard wings. They really do need, you know, a more of a defensive identity on that team. Now, is he going to do it on day one? Probably not. But I do like that fit for him, just because, you know, if he does come into Minnesota, there is already sort of a pecking order there. but it's still a young team, right? So he has time to kind of grow into, you know, a role as a guy who can score it and who can, you know, get a stop and late in the game, you know, when it matters, you know, you can stick him on whoever the best perimeter guy is, right? So it's just tough because a lot of things with him are theoretical. But the other question is just like, how much of it is bad feel and how much of it is lack of experience? Because like, he did not play a lot of high level basketball in high school. He went to a small high school. You know, he didn't play EYBL Nike, which I think actually is a higher level of competition relative to some of the other AU circuits. So, you know, you can call it nitpicking or whatever, but you know, he reclassified, right? So, you know, last year could have been his senior year of high school. And so it's just something we have to keep in mind. And he just turned 19. So it's a situation where I'm willing to look at that as more of like a blank slate with Edwards as far as what you can get him to be, rather than like, you know, his feel is so bad, I would never bet on that guy, right? That's just my perspective. But I think it makes sense for them.
So the Warriors are sitting there at number two, and it's not revelatory to say that they are willing to deal that pick. They are open to hearing from teams that want to come up, move, and get that pick. I mean, how valuable do you think that pick is going to be? And what are you hearing about teams that could be interested in jumping up and who they might try to grab?
Yeah, you know, it sounds like they are already, you know, making that pick available, which they should. I think there's probably a trade market to the extent that, you know, at least once everybody figures out for sure who's going number one, I mean, it's, you know, they can basically be like, this is whichever of whoever's left, you know, if it's someone who wants Ball, if it's someone who really likes Wiseman. I think there'll be enough of a trade market that they can do it. Knowing that they have the trade exception, from the Iguodala deal, it gives them a lot of options, right? I mean, if you think about it, they could do a deal where, you know, like I've speculated, well, maybe they try to get a star. I don't really know what's out there in terms of like people they could actually get and have enough to get.
Well, that's the thing. Right. That's the thing too. Like there's not, I mean, they'd love to get their hands on Bradley Beal. He's not going to be available this offseason. They'd love to get their hands on Ben Simmons. He's not going to be available this offseason. What I would wonder is, even though the Warriors don't need a player like a Wiseman or a Ball, if there's not that big deal available, is it smarter to draft that player, develop him, and then maybe trade him at midseason if, you know, one of the players I just mentioned does become available? Because I think that's possible. Like if, you know, let's say that Washington goes into the crapper, John Wall isn't the same player, Davis Bertans doesn't work out, like then Bradley Beal could be available. So I wonder if there's merit in just using the pick and holding on to that player until midseason.
Yeah, I think that's possible too. I think one thing to keep in mind as well, you know, what they can do also is if they find someone who's willing to take Wiggins' contract, right? I mean, maybe you can take back, instead of one player, you can look at maybe two players. Like, you know, you can pick up two veterans or whatever, you know, to equal his salary. It's a big salary. And then you can do the deal in two parts, right? Where, you know, that's one part of the deal. And the other piece of the deal is you send the pick and they send another player back into the trade exception. Right. And it's a $17 million exception. So they actually have a lot of flexibility there. So, I mean, it could be even a situation where they're looking at picking up two or three players from one team. I don't know who that would be. But if there's a team that's like, you know what, we're going to move on from some of our core guys, you know, they can do that. And, you know, they can send, again, the biggest thing is you have to incentivize someone to take the Wiggins deal, which I don't think anyone really wants. But between this pick and then they have next year's pick from Minnesota, which is top three protected, which is actually a pretty valuable pick because, like you said, if Minnesota doesn't get this right, and even if they do, they still might be the worst team in the West next year. And that's still, you know, a decent chance you might get that pick, even if it's not top three. You know, a top four through seven pick in next year's draft, which looks like a really good draft class, is valuable. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what they can really fetch. But I always think that, you know, when teams are looking at, you know, how are we going to change this up, you know, a top five pick is always attractive and you can always tuck yourself into somebody and it always happens. So I think it's the other thing to keep in mind is it's so early right now and we don't even know what the salary cap is going to be for sure. So, you know, if that cap number goes down a little bit, it might impact, you know, the type of moves teams are able to make. So, you know, I think it'll probably be a little while before we kind of get a better idea of what is really on the table.
So you say next year's draft is looking like a pretty good one. I mean, how deep is this one? You know, we've talked Edwards and LaMelo, a little bit of Wiseman. I mean, how deep in terms of top level talent do you see this draft?
Yeah, top level talent, not so much. I mean, you know, there's that next group of guys. You know, I mean, I really like Tyrese Haliburton. I've told you that before. You know, he's a guy who I really believe in. And I think there will be good, like, high level role players that you can find.
You're going to die on this right? Tyrese Haliburton hill.
Oh, yeah, I will.
Like, if he turns out to be a bust, that's going to be on you.
That guy's way too smart to be a bust. You know, at worst case scenario, he's like going to be like a really, really good like bench rotation player to me. That's like high, like worst case scenario. I see him being like a contributor on a really good team coming off the bench. But I mean, if you just look at it, I mean, I don't think there are really a lot of guys with like crazy all-star potential, which is okay. But you just have to keep it in perspective. So like, depends on how you want to define deep. If you want to look at deep in the sense that, hey, we might get a guy at 19 or 20 who is just as good, if not better, than a guy who goes 7 or 8. Yeah, this is that type of draft, right? It's a better draft, actually, for, you know, teams picking in the teens. I think that's probably where the value sweet spot is. I think that's where you're going to see teams shopping their picks. You know, teams that made the playoffs this year looking to pick up, hopefully, you know, add another player or two. I think that's where sort of that market's going to be in the mid to late first round. You know, also you might find a guy in the second round who ends up being a little bit better than someone who goes, you know, 10 picks earlier. It's just, again, it depends on how you want to define deep. It's a flat draft where it's like there's not a great talent gap, but then it falls off towards the end. But so as long as you're not picking the top five, I don't think it's like a train wreck. It's just you have to, you know, keep your expectations realistic.
But if you're a team like Boston, is this the kind of draft you want to have 3 first round picks in?
Yes and no. I mean, they have 14. I think, you know, well, Boston's a weird case because they, you know, they rostered 3 rookies last year.
Yeah, they don't need.
They're going to have to do something because they can't take that many guys on. They'll have to consolidate in some way. But like, there's no reason you can't just take a huge upside swing, right? I mean, there are still guys who have upside. They may not hit it. But you know, at 14, you know, they'll have their pick of. There'll be a lot of guards on the board. They can kind of do what they want. You know, maybe they stash someone with one of the later picks. Maybe I would assume 26 and 30 are available, just by process of elimination, really. But I don't think it's a great draft to pick at the top. But there are still going to be guys who end up being good because that happens every year.
So as you look ahead at some of the high risk, maybe high reward guys. Really, the guys that Denver's picked in the last couple of years, whether it's Michael Porter Jr., who certainly looks like a player during this restart and really all season. Bol Bol, you know, had his moments playing for Denver during the seeding games. It looks like he's going to be something for that team. Is there a guy you've got your eye on there, maybe one with some red flags around him that could drop that has, you know, real talent that could be a value pick?
Yeah, you know, it's worth noting that one thing I've heard a lot is that one good thing about this draft is like a lot of the, you know, top 15, 20 guys are like pretty high character guys. You know, everyone's interviewed well. There's some level of confidence that these are, you know, good dudes you're going to bring in, which always helps, right? With your level of confidence where a guy's not going to totally bust. But if you want to look at this from the perspective of guys who, you know, if you're ever talking about Mike Porter and Bol, you know, those are guys who were hyped in high school, you know, for whatever reason, stock kind of dipped between injuries or, you know, both those guys had some concerns in terms of off-court stuff that, you know, seem to be okay right now. If you want to look at guys who sort of value have dived but might be good value picks and available outside the lottery, I mean, I think Cole Anthony is one. I've never been a big believer in him necessarily, but he did, you know, he was really good in high school. Had a rough year. I think right now you could say, you know, this is a buy-low opportunity if you believe in his skill set. You know, I think he'll be there for teams in the late lottery in the teens. You could look at like a Jaden McDaniels where he was not good this year at Washington. But you could just look at his body and just the fact that it's hard to find wings that have sort of the size he has and the sort of skill framework is what I'll call it. I don't know if he's there yet. But, you know, guys like that are interesting buy low opportunities sort of in the middle late first round. Is there like a Michael Porter where it's like this guy could be an all-star if he stays healthy, or like a Bol where it's like this guy was really, really productive, but we don't know still how it's going to translate? I don't know if there's that. I mean, another one of the, you know, high upside perceived guys is Alexi Pokuševski, the Serbian forward who has a basically 7 feet tall, terrible body, but interesting skill set. But it might be like 4 years before we know if he's any good, just because it's going to take him a while to get there. But, you know, he sounds like he'll go in the first round too in that back half. So if we're talking about upside, I mean, those are the types of guys where, you know, you're kind of taking a shot. But how confident am I in any of them? I don't know if I'm like super, super on board with any of those things. But those are some of the ones that come to mind.
So the second round guys, anyone in particular you're especially high on as kind of one of those sleeper picks?
Yeah, Xavier Tillman from Michigan State, I love. I think it's possible he sneaks into the first round. I think he's great value in the 30s. I think he's probably the best, at least right now, defensive big in the draft. It's just that he's 6'8". He's a little bit smaller. But he can really pass, just really, really capable defender, shut down. You know, the Big Ten was a good league for bigs this year, and Tillman did a really good job, you know, night to night, just on everybody pretty much. Coming from Michigan State, you know you're going to get someone who's competitive and is going to do what you need them to do. So I think he's a guy I'm pretty confident in. I like Malachi Flynn from San Diego State, another guy who had a really, really good college season. I think he can walk in and be, you know, a decent backup right away. And then Peyton Pritchard from Oregon, another guy I like. Just I kind of think he's so tough and he can make shots. I think he finds a way onto a roster. I don't think it's a bad second round. I mean, there's going to be, you know, a bunch of bigs and a bunch of guards kind of on the board there. I'm sure some of them will be on rosters for the next few years, but it really depends who you are. Those are some of the names that I like.
You know, the it's not even just the guys that are drafted. I mean, we're seeing in the playoffs right now undrafted guys making an impact. I mean, Fred VanVleet is the most notable, but I look at what Lu Dort is doing with Oklahoma City. I mean, what did teams miss on him? I mean, clearly he's got some offensive flaws, but what a great defensive player he's developed into. Was a great defensive player in college, but has really developed into one of the better perimeter defenders already in this league. I mean, when you look back at last year, what do you think teams missed about him?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was actually talking to someone about this, someone in the front office about this, a couple of days ago, and you know, his perception was that Dort was not a great defender in college and didn't guard enough, which is interesting.
That executive missed on that one,
right? But
yeah, that was
But at the same time, I think the knock was that he was such a wild offensive player. I don't have the stats in front of me, but like, I mean, I had him, I think, 32 or 33 on our rankings last year, which I guess looks good. I don't know if I really care about that, but you know, at least I didn't have him undrafted. But yeah, I think everybody's a little bit, you know, just in this role where he's bought in, you know, he obviously is making a really good impact in that series. Just as he can at least keep up with James Harden physically. And, you know, I think actually if there's an interesting trend to look at, you know, based on these bubble games, it's guys like Dort and guys like Gary Trent who have bought in defensively and, you know, looked like totally different players than they did in college. You know, Gary Trent never guarded at all in high school. He was a guy who got buckets, and at Duke, that was a weird Duke team with Bagley, but you know, Duke, he just kind of shot threes and was there and didn't always impact the game beyond that. So, you know, seeing guys like that buy in, I wonder if that gives you more hope for if you're looking at wings who kind of have tools and can kind of shoot. Maybe it's hope that, hey, if this guy buys in, you know, he can do this for us too. So, like, you could look at, like, a Jamias Ramsey from Texas Tech this year, I think is an interesting one where, you know, I don't think the buy-in was really there in his 1 year in college, but he can shoot it. And in high school, people were really interested by his tools. You know, he's a bigger kind of off guard. And, you know, that's the type of guy who could sort of, I could see doing that in a couple of years.
Trent is just fearless out here. I mean, I don't know what he's really doing defensively. I mean, he's kind of guarding LeBron, but like more nominally, given that LeBron's playing out of his mind right now. Mm-hmm. You know, Dort in Oklahoma City, a team that invested in Andre Roberson and believed in Andre Roberson. Like, it feels like Dort is the next Andre Roberson for them, a guy that is extremely raw offensively, doesn't have a great perimeter game, but gets into you on the defensive end. I mean, he's, for a guy this young to play this well defensively, I mean, he reminds me a lot of Marcus Smart with the way he's playing. And there's just a level of skill and physicality that when you blend them together, I think he's going to be a really good defender for years to come. I think Oklahoma City's got something here in Lu Dort.
I think so too. And, you know, it's not like he's a non-shooter. Like, I think you could at this point say Roberson is pretty much a non-shooter. You know, at least Dort occasionally will hit one to keep you honest. Like, you're still going to live and die with it. But if he can at least hit, you know, 32% of threes or whatever, I mean, that's pretty solid with what else he brings to the table. And again, they have the benefit of being able to pair him with other creative guards where he doesn't really have to do too much.
All right, let me finish with this. It's a strange draft process. There was no conference tournaments. There was no NCAA tournament. There are allegedly going to be combines, but maybe they're virtual, and I have no idea how any of that's going to work. I mean, how challenging is it going to be for team executives to figure this out? I mean, how much more guesswork is going to go into this than maybe there has been in years past?
Yeah, well, I think you can look at it a couple ways. I mean, as far as the combine goes, from what I understand, it's going to be all virtual. You know, they'll try to bring players into like regional sites and do the at least do some measurements and do medical testing, because teams need that for their own purposes, whether it's like, you know, having the measurements for analytic models and just having, you know, being able to not, you know, see the guy's bill of health. I mean, that's important. You know, how many of the top prospects go to that? I don't know. But I think you can safely say it's not going to be, it's more valuable just from that information gathering perspective than scouting. You know, all the scouting is pretty much going to be done or is done already. Like, I know there are teams who have prepared like the draft was going to be in June and are already basically like wrapped up and looking at next year, which is good. I mean, the one thing also is I think that at least for top level executives who make the decisions, they've had infinite time now basically to watch these players. So even though you miss out on the opportunity, hey, you know, there are a lot of GMs who are really like to see guys live before you take them. Obviously, this year is not the case, so the comfort level is different. But, you know, at the same time, you know, if you're really interested in the player, you can watch all of his games. You've had time to do that. So, you know, it's really just going to be more based on tape and intel. And, you know, the intel is intel every year. People are, you know, so deep on that across the league. So I think it's different, but at the same time, I almost think there's like fewer excuses to miss just because you've had so much more time to really watch games. So it'll be interesting to see like if there is a lasting trend, but we probably won't know for a while. But at least from my perspective, like I don't see it as like a deal breaker. Like I think more bad decisions are probably made off live workouts than good ones.
Well, they certainly have had a lot of time to watch all that tape. There's no question about that with what's been going on. So, maybe that will lead to some good decisions. Jeremy, appreciate your time, man. You can follow Jeremy's stuff on SI.com. He's writing regularly about what's going on. His draft board's up there right now. Follow him on Twitter, at Jeremy Wu. Good luck, man. I know it's going to be a busy couple of months for you.
Yeah, I know. Well, who knows, right?
Yeah, but, maybe.
Yeah, it's been a long enough wait already. So at this point, you know, just what's another month, right?
Exactly. Appreciate your time, man.
All right, man. Take care.
Coming up next, my conversation with Taj Gibson. All right, Taj Gibson is here, 11-year NBA veteran. Taj is partnering with Scotch Painter's Tape and Project Backboard to completely transform the basketball courts at the Ingersoll Houses in Brooklyn, New York, where Taj grew up, with bright and colorful murals. The project is currently scheduled to be unveiled to the public on Sunday, August 30th. Kind enough to join me here on the show. What's happening, Taj?
Hey, how you doing? What's going on?
It's another day in the NBA bubble, man. Let me ask you that first. I know the Knicks weren't... You know, one of the teams that weren't invited to come down and participate in the restart. How did you feel about it though? If the Knicks were invited, how would you have felt about it?
It would have felt great just being in the bubble and get a chance to play amongst some of the best players, and certainly in some weird circumstances to be playing some basketball. I think it would have been a great thing, especially to learn and be around with your teammates. It's always good.
Have you talked to any guys that are down here?
Not really, because I'm really just focusing on trying to help my community and do different things. But I talk to guys from time to time, but everybody seemed to be doing their normal thing, other than just being able to see their family every day as usual.
Yeah, I think guys have settled into some kind of boring routine. Like, I think they tried some things down here, but then it's just like, it's like, screw it. We're going to play video games and, you know, have Madden tournaments and things like that.
That's why I asked you, did you go fishing? Because a lot of guys I talked to and I seen they've been going fishing a lot. So I was just asking.
Yeah, I mean, Paul George, he does a lot of fishing, but he might be the one guy that is constantly out there. What's it been like? What's it been like for you, Taj, to not have basketball for this long? I'd imagine this is the longest time you've been away from the game.
It's a weird feeling because at first you were just working out in your house. You had a couple dumbbells and certain things. You're trying to stay in shape. Then the gym's closed. You're trying to get a gym. You're trying to stay in shape, trying to just see the basketball rim. You know what I'm saying? And then as months went on, finally got a chance to see a gym. Then you got to go through so many different protocols and things like that. Now things are a little bit died down. And I've been able to go to the gym and work out. But it's still limits. It's still an uphill battle. But I'm just happy to be working out again, you know, because it was a tough a few months where we couldn't even go outside.
Are you? I know teams are going to start doing team workouts. I know you've got your own contract situation to work out, but are you anticipating being part of that?
The workouts?
Yeah.
They're voluntary, but why not? It's always good to get out there and just be around the guys, even though the circumstances, but you still want to get out there and just still get some reps up, be able to stay in shape. And at the end of the day, it is basketball. So you just want to stay around the game of basketball. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was bouncing around the bubble here today, going to different practices, and it's obvious that what happened with Jacob Blake over the weekend in Wisconsin has really resonated with these guys. I mean, I honestly, Taj, feels like it felt like a broken spirit inside this bubble amongst some of the guys that I talked to and that spoke on these Zoom calls. What was your reaction to what you saw on that video over the weekend?
When I saw the video, I was disappointed. That's my first reaction. I was just really disappointed, but it seems like things like this happen all the time. It's become a new norm now.
Yeah. We ask players all the time what more they would like to see, because I get the sense that a lot of guys are, you know, frustrated that they feel like their voices are not enough in this situation, that they wish there was more that could be done. Is, in your mind, is there more that can be done in this moment? Is there more that the league could do? Is there more that team owners can do? I mean, how do you feel about that?
Right now, I don't know right now. Right now, it's really tough right now. We got a lot of stuff going on, especially including myself and dealing with the pandemic, dealing with my own problem, my own neighborhood. I'm trying to mainly focus on trying to teach my neighborhood and teaching the kids in my neighborhood how to react in situations, how to take what's going on right now in society and educate them. I can only do what I can do on my side. I can't speak for everybody else. My mission right now is to try to educate my neighborhood. I can only start with where I can really plant my feet at. And that's my stance on it. My stance is it's tough right now. We got a lot of stuff going on from basketball, sports, all kind of things. When I immediately saw that happen, I was disappointed because it's becoming a new norm. I just really hope that we can come together as a country and figure something out. You know, we got a lot of stuff going on, brother.
Yeah. Yeah. Some players have talked about, you know, because they don't feel like their voices are enough. Some players have talked about not playing, even moving forward in this current playoffs. I mean, is that something everybody's got to make it their own individual minds, but is that something that you believe would be impactful?
If they want to play, they can come play on my basketball court.
Yeah.
They can come to the hood, they can come play on my court, but I'm just kidding. But I think it would be something to talk about. I know for sure if you stop the game of basketball, because I know a lot of people, I know including myself, is extremely happy to see the game back on television, live action back on television. So who knows? I'm not shocked of anything new going on in today's world with so many things going on in our country, but we'll have to wait and see. But if it does, I hope something positive comes out of it.
You talked about what you're trying to do in your own backyard, talking to kids in your community. When you do talk to them about what's going on in this country, what do you say?
Keep your eyes open. Be aware of what's going on in your surroundings. Always be cautious. Always be polite. Always be aware. Always have your guard up. That's the first thing they told us when we was growing up in the neighborhood. Always have your hands up. Always have your guard up. Always have your eyes aware. And that's the main thing I'm doing now. But now I'm trying to do that with involving education. Mm-hmm. Teaching them the dailies about how to go to school, how to do their homework, how to really be prepared for the next level. Is it high school? Is it college? And this is daily. I'm always in my neighborhood. If it's involving toy drives, food drives, cold drives, you name it, I'm involved. From refurbishing basketball courts. But my ultimate goal now, I'm trying to help the young ladies. And that's my next goal, because I've been working with a lot of young men in my neighborhood, but now with so many things going on with women and such things like that, I need to shift some of my stances to help my young ladies in my neighborhood and throughout Brooklyn and so forth and other places I've been around.
Do you feel like the events of the last couple of months, whether it's the Breonna Taylor killing George Floyd and now what we saw in Milwaukee, I mean, when you talk to kids about these incidents, I mean, do they resonate strongly with them? I mean, how have they reacted to what they've had to see with their own eyes in the last few months?
And the one thing about children today, they're highly intelligent, and they're highly aware, and they have their phones 24/7.
Right.
So the kids were to bring it to me beforehand, but they're highly aware, but don't understand. They understand what's important and what's not important. They understand how to read the facts and what's not, and how to go about things. That's the main thing that I'm more so proud of when I speak to the children in my neighborhood, because they highly understand of what's going on, but they understand it's bigger than just going out there doing negatives and trying to harm people. They're actually trying to start the pledge to try to get votes. One kid walked up to me no more than maybe 3 days ago, and he wanted to have a Stop the Violence voter registration. And I was just like, I was mind blown, but just because the simple fact of the matter that's what we're talking about in my neighborhood now. We're really actually talking about votes, helping the community, helping get better schools. That's the main goal we're trying to do with my community and my foundation.
Do you think these kids are mobilized? I mean, obviously the 18-year-olds, do you think they're mobilized like maybe never before? I mean, if they're talking about voting at such a young age, do you think there'll be, you know, a mobilization of that vote in November?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so, because you're seeing a lot. One thing, if you watch a lot of young guys, you watch a lot of the rap now, it's a lot of movements going on. You know what I'm saying? It's a lot of movements where generation is being highly aware and highly intelligent. So I'm seeing a complete shift. A lot of people may say this or that's going on, but when I'm on the ground, hitting the ground and moving through the neighborhoods, moving through different projects, because I've been doing this NYCHA thing where I've been feeding the New York City housing workers. So while I'm going through all these neighborhoods and we're really going and hitting the ground running, these kids in these different neighborhoods are speaking the same kind of tone and language that other kids in different neighborhoods are talking. Mm-hmm. That means that we're bridging the gap. So it may be a big gap, but we're bridging the gap piece by piece.
Is part of all this, of what you're doing with this Project Backboard and with Scotch Painter's Tape for the basketball court, is that all part of what you're trying to build in your community?
Yeah. Just working with Scotch Painter's Tape it was just amazing, because I didn't really think that they would just come out of nowhere and just be willing to help, because I'm just so used to going through things myself. You know what I'm saying? Ever since I came in the NBA, I've just been coming out of my own pocket, just trying to help as much as I can. And by them coming on, it's been a blessing, because I'm really trying to help the kids in my community throughout Brooklyn and I just think it was awesome. But the things we're trying to do on the court is just a small piece. I'm just trying to give back as much as I can because I understand at once on one time or another, I was on the court when the rims were broke. It was tough to go outside. It wasn't safe. I'm trying to change that. I'm working with the New York City Police Department. They've been helping me with make sure the babies and the kids are safe, safe environment, helping me do different things with the court, different community affairs. My community is growing in a positive way, and I'm extremely happy at the movement that we're pushing towards.
So when you are, I mean, when you do have an opportunity to power down a little bit, how much of these games in the bubble have you been watching?
I really watch all the games.
Yeah,
I do. I watched the Clipper game. I was jumping around because I understand Joakim's on the Clippers.
Yeah,
I played Moop. He recently got traded from us. He's a good team. He was a great teammate. I'm rooting for him, but it's some good basketball out there, man. Every game is a weird setting, but I like it because you understand. We were cooped up in the house for months with no live TV. Everything was all documents and old flicks, old videos. my mom, she pulling out old video cassette tapes. I'm like, oh, this can't be life right now, but. I'm extremely happy to see that live basketball game, brother. That's the main thing.
I love
games are the games.
I got to tell you, I the first scrimmage I went to here, you know, Joakim started because Zubac was dealing with his stuff, and like he hasn't played in like a year plus, and he's flying up and down the floor like he's 25 years old still, man. It's still same energy.
He was so excited, like even while he was training, he's just so excited to get another chance. Just get another chance at it, especially in the playoffs with a team that's got a chance maybe to go all the way. He's so happy and excited. I'm super excited for him.
Tell me the truth. How often do you think about the potential of those early 2010s Bulls teams? Because they might be one of the better ones this century to not win a championship.
Think about it every day. When you think about all those tough games, all those tough battles with some great teammates that you went to war day to day, from practice to tough games, late nights. You know what I'm saying? I think about it every day because that'll never change. All those tough times, all those good games we smiled after. It was amazing, man. I wouldn't change nothing. I wouldn't change nothing. But things happen for a reason, and it was a great time in my life.
And the year Derek got hurt in that first round, that felt like your year. Like you were a year older, the playoffs, you were tougher. That felt like your year.
Yeah, I felt like we were during that. I think we were much more polished and more experienced and ready for the. I thought we were more ready for like the later parts of the playoffs. Mm-hmm. I guess once you get deeper in the playoffs, you kind of envision yourself getting back there faster, knowing that how hard it is to get there. And when that happened, it was like – it was a shock because, you know what I'm saying, you go to war just got day to day. Mm-hmm. I see your teammates more than your family. So it's really a brotherhood, man, really a brotherhood.
Are you potentially ready for a third tour of duty with Tom Thibodeau?
God willing, I'm always ready. That's my coach. He's always done a phenomenal job of just getting guys prepared, getting guys ready. That's like my pops, man. Like he taught me almost everything I know about NBA basketball. So we'll see.
Three tours with Tibbs That's something. That's the you're unique out there, Taj. Doing that.
The only thing left after that is to be a coach, assistant coach, and I'll be like Ed Pigme, following Ed Pigme's footsteps.
There you go, Taj. Good luck with everything with the transformation of the basketball court. We look forward to seeing that on Sunday, August 30th, and good luck in getting back in these workouts, and hopefully see you back on the court real soon.
Thanks, brother. be safe out there, man. Go fishing, brother.
Hell no. That's not going to work for me, man. Video games, or I'm playing like old school Sega Genesis now. Like like NHL 94 is what I'm looking at right now.
Oh, that was it. That was it though.
Swingers, man. Like the greatest movie scene of all time is when they're making Gretzky's head bleed in Swingers.
Yo, that's crazy. I'm about to go buy that. What is it called? Which one was it? 93 or 94?
I believe the one. Like, so one of them got rid of fighting, right? And got rid of bleeding. Like, that was the one don't want. I think 93 is the one that you can make Gretzky's head bleed. I think that's the one. But I appreciate it, man. Good luck to you.
All right, bro.
Take care.